Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is 2019-1787 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Nicholson. Mr. Tyak, good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy. And may it please the court. My name is Jonathan Tyak, and I, along with my co-counsel, Holly Klein, represent Matthew Nicholson. This is an appeal on a death penalty verdict. And as I will talk about here momentarily, the fundamental fact of the matter is that Mr. Nicholson did not receive a fair trial in Cuyahoga County Common Pleas Court. There's a number of reasons for that. But before I dive into some of the facts and some of the issues in the record, I want to bring before the court what I see as an important legal question that this case provides this court with an opportunity to address. A legal question that involves a dispute between districts, a legal question that courts throughout Ohio need guidance on. And that's the legal question that's raised in our fifth proposition of law relating to the bright line test, the bright line rule in Cuyahoga County relating to the inability to receive both a self-defense instruction and a voluntary manslaughter instruction in any kind of murder prosecution. This is an important question, and the 8th District's bright line test is different from the test that's been articulated in the 7th District. There are other districts that have indicated a willingness to follow one district or the other. The 4th seems to be indicating that it will follow the 7th. The 10th, although it hasn't expressly stated, seems to be more in line with the 8th. And this is an important question that this court should address. What makes this case such a great vehicle for this court to address this issue is that it really is reduced to a legal question at this point. And essentially, the rule that we're challenging is this bright line rule that says that an instruction on self-defense and an instruction for voluntary manslaughter as a lesser offense are inherently and legally incompatible. Such a rule defies logic, and it defies the plain elements of both instructions. Obviously, the 8th District has stated that self-defense must be based on fear, and the mitigation of a homicide charge or a murder charge to voluntary manslaughter must be based on sudden passion or fit of rage. It must be based on anger. And the emotion of anger is mutually exclusive with the emotion of fear. The faulty logic of this rule is abundantly clear, in my opinion, as a matter of human nature. Anger and fear are not mutually exclusive. Anger and fear often happen simultaneously. The common cliche is fight or flight. And when somebody is presented with a threat that evokes a fight or flight response, sometimes they do one, sometimes they do the other, sometimes it's a combination of both. And so common experience would tell you that anger and fear are not mutually exclusive. But the other problem that the rule presents is that it ignores the plain language and longstanding elements of what it means to act in self-defense. The mitigation of a murder charge to a voluntary manslaughter charge is one that requires a showing of anger. It's one that requires a showing of rage. There is an emotional prerequisite for that instruction to be given. There has to be a factual basis, even when looking at the evidence in a light most favorable to the defendant, there has to be a factual basis for that instruction.
Counselor, is there anything that is analyzed along with that, the element of rage being temporal to what, and what provokes the rage, and if the rage isn't provoked, or if the rage is more subjective than objective, and then the timing with which the rage and the act of firing a weapon occurs?
Yes, there's always a factual inquiry, Your Honor, as to whether the voluntary manslaughter instruction is appropriate. And I apologize, Chief Justice Kennedy. I realized I failed to reserve my rebuttal time. May I have leave of court to reserve 10 minutes in rebuttal?
Absolutely.
I apologize. I got carried away. I apologize, Justice Stewart. Absolutely, there would be a factual inquiry in every case as to whether the instruction is appropriate. It's a sudden fit of passion or rage brought on by sufficient provocation such that it would trigger such a reaction in an ordinary person. And every trial judge has an obligation to consider the evidence and consider the record in the case to determine if such an instruction is appropriate. Here, the record creates an appropriate record for this instruction. In fact, when this instruction was requested by defense counsel at the trial, the state did not challenge it on factual grounds. The state simply cited the precedent in Cuyahoga County called State versus Jefferson and some of the cases that say they're mutually exclusive. Defense counsel can choose one or can choose the other, but you can't get both.
Counsel, what are the facts in this case that would establish provocation?
Well, according to the evidence in the record, and again, when viewing it in a light most favorable to Matt Nicholson, this was a situation where Matt originally started having an argument with his live-in girlfriend, America Polanco, because of some text messages from another male suitor or ex-boyfriend. That argument was verbal at the time, but it was heated. At that point, America's child, ML, 17-year-old young man, confronted Matt, and a physical altercation ensued. There was literally a fist fight that broke out in the kitchen. And then there were other involvement by America. America was involved in this physical altercation as well. So tempers were flaring. Prior to that, Matt had been asking to leave. He'd been asking for people to move their cars. That wasn't happening, so he couldn't leave. That continued to make him angry. And so it was an escalation over a very short period of time to a point where there was a very significant physical altercation in the house with a 17-year-old man that essentially was a fist fight. And at that point, Matt had been provoked into a fit of rage that contributed to his behavior that night.
But didn't he go and get the gun and then like a minute later return with it?
Well, Your Honor, and again,
I remember the record, but.
Yeah. I mean, as he went into his bedroom was feet away, closer than the distance between you and I right now. That's all diagrammed in the briefs. I want to say from the doorway to the kitchen, and my colleagues on the other side would correct me, but I believe it was like 8 feet to get to the bedroom, and then the gun was already there. That's where he always kept it.
Because he had a plan to kill, right? Planned contingency to kill. That was your brief.
No, he did not have a plan to kill. He went and got his gun. He was in a fit of rage. The kids went out the side door,
right,
went to the left. That's an important fact because the only thing to the left was Matt's service weapon in his unlocked car. Escape was to the right. The kids didn't go to the right. They went to the left.
But they didn't have a gun.
Not until they got into Matt's car.
Did they ever have a weapon?
Yes.
In their hand. They were in possession of his service gun.
Yes.
When they were shot.
That's what we believe the record reflects and supports.
Well, I mean, I want to go back because now I found the reference. Nicholson merit brief at 74, he argues the threats do not support prior calculation, blah, 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 and merely establish, quote, planned contingency to kill, close quote. That's your words.
That does
from the State v. Reed case.
Right. Now, again, that's in response to the state's argument that The state presented evidence through America Polanco that Mr. Nicholson in the past had made threats that he would kill the children if certain things happened. That was uncorroborated, but that was America's testimony. And so the state argued, we're shifting over to the prior calculation design argument here a little bit, Your Honor, but I'm happy to do that. The state argued at the time of trial, and I think argues now, that those threats establish prior calculation and design. And again, the Reed case is illustrative and I think instructive here. That was the one where Mr. Reed said, if any police officer messes with me, I'm going to shoot him. And I think he said it even within a month of the incident. These are allegations that Mr. Nicholson denies, but...
But there is testimony.
But there is testimony to it. And that testimony was that it had happened probably years prior, but that argument by us is in response to the state's argument that that creates prior calculation and design, and that argument in our brief is related to the suggestion that even if that's true, even if that happened, that's nothing other than a contingency plan, like in the Reed case. So that's where that comes into play, Your Honor.
Counselor, can you clarify for me where his service revolver that he kept in his car in his trunk, where was that recovered by the police officers?
It was recovered in the trunk of his car.
So you're saying that the children went and recovered the gun, were shot, left in the driveway, and somehow got the gun back into the trunk?
Well, the prevailing theory from our side of the case is that America Polanco put the gun back in the trunk of the car. She, and again, when you watch the videos, when you watch these body camera footage videos, which I know you probably have, America is right in that area. These are tight quarters. And so the kids go down kind of next to the Jeep Wrangler, kind of between the Jeep Wrangler and the Jetta. The Jetta is Matt's car. The Jeep Wrangler is America's car. And America is all in that area. And this brings up the other issue of the gun. I mean, this was an ongoing dispute, a discovery dispute, an evidentiary dispute. But the fact of the matter is that there is some real irregularity, if you will, about the evidence as it relates to the gun being in the trunk of the car. This is an important issue as it comes to Matt's ability to get a fair trial. After the incident on September 6th of 2018, officers search the house. They're looking for a big gun. The gun that shot the kids was found in the basement where Matt told the police it would be. What everybody's looking for was the service weapon, the weapon that belonged to Paragon Systems. And the reality is they weren't even really looking for it. They were looking for the big gun. In the process, they were also looking for car keys. They were looking for garage door openers. They were looking for other things. But a thorough search of the house was made. No other gun was found other than the one that Matt told them about. Then what happens is that certain officers come in and they claim to have searched the cars. But Officer Samia and Officer Pitts, they claim to search three cars. Well, there were five cars in the driveway. There's dispute about who searched the cars. At one point, Officer Petrick testified that he searched the cars, but Officer Petrick isn't even on the log. There's something like 36 or 37 other officers that were all there. It was diligently documented by the Garfield Heights Police Department, who was there. And Officer Petrick is not on the log, yet he testified he searched Matt's car. There's disputes about who searched Matt's car, who didn't search Matt's car. What we do know is that then on September 13th of 2018, about 7 days later, according to the search warrant from Detective Stroh, America calls Detective Stroh and tells him that she put the gun in the trunk of the car. It's in the last paragraph of a search warrant affidavit, and I believe it's Exhibit 344B, if memory serves me correct. But also that she had seen the gun belt and the ammunition in the car 2 days earlier. She denies that on the witness stand. But she admits putting the gun in the car. The search warrant is obtained, and the police come to the house. And nobody has on any body cameras. They do have a camera. They are taking pictures. And they take pictures, and they're in the record of the trunk open and the police in the trunk and a bag of clothes on the driveway. Those pictures are there. Likewise, there's a series of pictures of all the items that were taken out of the trunk, laying on the concrete. And it's the equipment you would expect for an armed security guard. It's all there. But there was about eight photos that Officer Petrick testified that he took that would have shown the inside of the trunk and the condition of the items in the trunk itself. Those pictures disappeared. Why is that important? Why is that exculpatory? Why is that potentially useful? If the gun wasn't in the holster when it was found in the trunk, that would have corroborated Matt's testimony.
Another question for you, counsel.
Yes,
sir. The medical examiner's report indicated that there was gun residue on the hands of the victims, but it was never tested. Is that anything we should be concerned about?
It is what it is. The state's expert testified that the gunshot came from more than 4 feet away. It could have been as close as 4 feet. There's no suggestion that the kids discharged the gun. And so, again, another anomaly in this strange case. But the video and the photos clearly show the close quarters, and it's consistent with Matt's testimony that he leaned out the door, sort of half in, half out that side door, and shot to alleviate what he perceived as a threat. Now, where the kids fell, and they're not very far. I mean, it could be 4 feet, it could be 5 feet, it could be give or take, but it's not very far.
And what was his threat perception?
His threat was that they had the gun, they'd retrieved his gun from his trunk.
But they weren't coming toward him.
They were standing in the driveway, and as I recall, his testimony was that ML turned with the gun, he then discharged his firearm, and then at some point Giselle had the gun in her hand too, and he discharged his firearm to neutralize her as well.
So the son, the brother, is seen by your client as having the gun.
Holding the gun, correct.
He gets shot.
Correct.
Then he passes the gun off to his sister. So then she...
Or she picks it up. I don't remember. I apologize. I don't remember the exact testimony on that. But they both ended up in possession of the gun at different times, and they were both shot. Now, what makes the gun important is that if that gun had been retained, if that gun was not retained. That gun was secured. The photos of where it was in the trunk went missing, and then the gun got returned to Paragon Systems. And so if the DNA of one of the children, or the DNA of America, or fingerprints of the children, or fingerprints of America had been on that gun, or on that gun belt, or on that box of ammunition, Mr. Nicholson's self-defense claim would be cast in a completely different light.
When he shot out the window, or whatever that was.
It was a door. But
door,
yeah,
yeah, door, I remember. Yeah. He emptied 8 into the ML?
He shot 13 times.
I thought it was 8 and 6, so 14.
Eight and 4 were the wounds. The 13th bullet hit Giselle's book bag.
That's right, okay. But ML was the one who got hit with 8, I think.
I believe that's correct.
Is there testimony he was standing up handing the gun to Giselle? You just said she maybe picked it up. I couldn't understand that part of the testimony.
The way I picture it is the kids are there, they have the gun, it's in their possession, they're getting it out of the holster, they're...
But he gets hit 8 times. That's a lot of...
Correct.
Gunshot wound.
Well, it was a semi-automatic weapon. It was fired rapidly. That's true. And
their entrance wounds were back inside, correct?
Most of them were. But again, a review of the many, many photos that we maintain were inappropriately admitted into evidence reveals that there were front and side entrance wounds as well. Not as many, 1 or 2. Again, they're all on the photos. They're right there. The autopsy report's in the record. And so... It is consistent with the kids turning, but not necessarily running. So again, Matt came out, he shot, and there's no evidence as to what order, it could have been hit one kid a couple times, hit him again. Again, there was no video of that part of the event. But the ultimate point is that that gun was not retained, and it materially prejudiced Matt's ability to maintain his self-defense argument. The photographs were outright lost, destroyed, overwritten. No good explanation was done with that. No motion to dismiss was filed by defense counsel. No hearing was had on that issue. There was discussion of it.
What about Mr. Nicholson's comments before he surrendered, before he was taken into custody?
He made many comments. He spent, I think, about 4 hours on the phone with Lieutenant Vargo, who was on the crisis team. His mother was on that call. He made many comments about how he had snapped. He made comments about how he'd blacked out. He made comments about how he'd lost control. He was apologetic. Lieutenant Vargo described him as being panicked. The notes that are all over the desk discuss how he was snapped or blacked out, lost control. Again, facts that support an instruction for voluntary manslaughter in this case. And the only reason that instruction wasn't given was because the trial court stated, and I'm going to simply read from the record here if I may, the trial court stated that he wasn't going to give the instruction because the court said, I'm going to go with our district, and they're holding on that.
Okay. So whether the trial court's right or wrong, though, what evidence is there in the record that would show provocation sufficient to incite an ordinary person to use deadly force?
Well, I think we talked about it in our brief, and I mentioned it today a little bit, but the fist fight with ML was the final big straw. That really was a very violent altercation.
You think that's evidence of provocation that would incite an ordinary person to use deadly force in this situation?
That accompanied with the discussion about going to get the gun, that accompanied with the discussion of the threat that was being made by the fact that the kids were going for the gun in Matt's car.
When you said the discussion about going to get the gun, who had that discussion? I thought the record indicated that your client is the one that...
That's my client's testimony.
About going to get... I don't recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, there being anything in the record that indicated that either of the children discussed going to get the gun, that one said to the other, go get the gun, or we're going to get the gun out of the car.
I would agree with that. I don't think there's evidence in the record that the children discussed it. I think there's evidence in the record that America was telling them where the gun was, and that, again, they went out the door, and the important fact here, Your Honor, is that they went left. There was nothing to the left but a garage and some other parked cars and some fences. If they were trying to get away, they would have gone right.
But wasn't the provocation in part that ML had called Giselle and 911?
There's no evidence in the record to suggest or support that Matt was aware of anybody calling 911. What happened was Giselle was getting home from work. America tells her son, ML, call Giselle, tell her not to come into the house because there was so much drama going on and there was this violent altercation with ML. And ML instead calls the police. He calls 911, and that's the first 911 call that is in the record. But there's no evidence to suggest that Matt knew anybody had called 911 at that point.
But the history is one of domestic violence, threats, don't call the police or I'll kill the kids. And so if that factually would be part of the fear or the provocation, I mean, is that even appropriate for us to consider?
You're talking about America's testimony that...
No, I'm saying that I'm not convinced that the only provocation was the kids running to the left, thinking that they might be getting his gun, but that he would get in trouble for his behavior at that time before the tragic events ever occurred.
Well, I mean, there's no evidence of that, of his thought process being, I don't want them to call the police. The evidence is there was a fist fight in the kitchen with ML after an escalating argument with ML's mother, and that violent episode ended with ML and Giselle leaving the house and going to the left where they knew the gun would be located.
So ML was 17, physically smaller than Matt, correct?
I believe he's a little smaller than Matt, yeah.
Yeah. And, okay. That's all.
But again, we're talking about a jury instruction here. This isn't, that we're not talking about, we're talking about when looking at the evidence in a light most favorable to Matt Nicholson, could a reasonable trier of fact have concluded that this was a voluntary manslaughter in this case? The answer is yes. The state never said otherwise at trial. The court never said otherwise at trial. The state never challenged the request for the voluntary manslaughter instruction on factual grounds. The court didn't deny the instruction on factual grounds. So this case presents this court with a purely legal question. Is an instruction for voluntary manslaughter and an instruction for self-defense?
But that's not the question that's before us. For you to prevail, you don't prevail by showing that those two instructions could be available in a particular case. You have to show in your case that there was sufficient evidence in the record to merit both of those instructions. Whether or not the Eighth District statement of the law is correct or incorrect is largely irrelevant. What you have to show is there's evidence in this case that merits those instructions. So I guess the question still is, what evidence is there that a reasonable person would be provoked to use deadly force?
The evidence is there, and we've discussed.
A reasonable person would use deadly force because they saw the kids going to the left?
He saw the kids going for the gun. He saw the kids
That might help with self-defense, but that doesn't help you with voluntary manslaughter.
Well, I would suggest it does, Your Honor. I think that the fact that he perceives the kids as going for a deadly weapon in an effort to continue the altercation with him, in an effort to present a threat to him, in an effort to harm him, that is provocation. It is also relevant for the belief that he is facing the imminent threat of serious physical harm or death. I see that I've already gone well into my rebuttal time. I will reserve my remaining comments. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, my name is Brandon Pateo, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Ohio, appellee in this matter. We are asking this court to affirm the convictions and the sentences of Mr. Nicholson for the aggravated murders of Giselle Lopez and ML, her 17-year-old brother, on September 5th, 2018. I'll begin where opposing counsel began, with the fifth proposition of law. That proposition asks this court to determine there was an abuse of discretion in the trial court's refusal to give both a self-defense instruction as well as an inferior offense instruction for voluntary manslaughter. The trial court did follow the Eighth District's consistent holdings on this matter. We cited Deloyd, Jefferson, I believe, was the first opinion. Those holdings consistently state that these two theories are incompatible.
Counselor, and what if we find that that's incorrect?
If you find that that was incorrect, there would be a question whether it was incorrect in totality or only incorrect to not consider the factual basis and rather incorrect just for following precedent.
But was it? If that was the Eighth District's decision and the trial court said we're going to go with our precedent here, then if we decide that that's an improper application of the law, then is that consideration made somewhere at some point, the trial court?
Why? Well, then this court, Your Honor, could consider whether or not there was sufficient provocation using the standard applied in State v. Shane.
Should we do that in the first instance?
No, Your Honor. This court should find that there was no abuse of discretion in following Eighth District precedent.
No, but I'm saying if we decide that that's an improper statement of the law, does this court decide in the first instance whether there was fact sufficient for adequate provocation?
Yes, this court could make that decision.
As opposed to the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it would be appropriate because if the trial court's decision was correct, even though its reasoning for that decision was made on an incorrect basis. If this court held that following precedent or that precedent was incorrect and that was a wrong decision, it still wouldn't be an abuse of discretion. And this court shouldn't send it back to the trial court if this court determines that the evidence in the record does not support sufficient provocation under the standards set forth in Shane.
That's what I wanted to get back to, because it looks to me from the facts and the record and the situation of this family that the domestic violence situation was severe, and this sort of underlying threat that if you report me to the police, I'll harm you or your children. And I don't know that we're sure that he knew that ML called 911 or not, but we know that he at least made a call to his sister or was instructed to make a call to his sister. And I guess what I'm asking is, would the jury be, would the jury acceptably be able to infer that that's not a valid provocation?
Yes, Your Honor, that was not a valid provocation. Going through the question that you asked, and starting with how this provocation or how this assumed provocation began, yes, there was a significant history of domestic violence in this household. The state put on evidence so that in part the jury and this court in reviewing would know that when ML went to her mother's room on September, to his mother's room on September 5th, 2018, it was not the first incident. It was not the first time that his mother had been strangled in that house, that Mr. Nicholson put his hands on America in that house. That was important information for the jury to know and for this court to know. Further, in the transcript at 3289, America testified that there were repeated threats by Mr. Nicholson that he would kill her children if the police were ever called. He made it clear to America that he did not want to leave that house. He was in that house for years. There were issues for years, and he did not want to get in trouble. But that is not a basis for him to have sufficient provocation to get an inferior instruction of manslaughter. By choosing to strangle America that night, which was America's testimony, that ML comes to the door, is banging on the door, hearing his mother being abused by her boyfriend, Matthew Nicholson.
And there's evidence of physical evidence in the record about that, is there?
There are photographs that were taken at the hospital. They do not show significant injuries to America, but there is significant testimony by America. In regard to sufficient provocation, as this court held in Shane, words alone are not ordinarily enough for sufficient provocation. In this case, there were the booking photos of Matthew Nicholson, as well as the booking report submitted into evidence. Those photos and that report demonstrated no injuries to Mr. Nicholson.
What about the weapon, his service revolver, and the missing pictures and the inability to find the weapon in the first search and then a later search that discovered the weapons?
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the search for that weapon, it's very important for this court to know the timeline of what's occurring in this case. On September 5th, the police respond, and there are two wounded people in this driveway, severely wounded. Four gunshot wounds to Giselle, eight to ML.
And no evidence of a gun around them.
Correct. There is no evidence whatsoever that more than one gun was fired. There is no evidence whatsoever that Jetta was implicated.
What about the residue on ML's hands?
The state's expert testified that there was gunshot residue on the clothing of the victims, and these victims fell roughly on top of each other. If the court reviews the body camera videos in state's exhibits 321, 322, 323, those videos were crucial evidence to understanding what took place in that driveway in terms of the proximity to the side door where the victims fled and from which Mr. Nicholson reached out and shot them. And I do want to briefly address, when the autopsy photos are examined, exhibits 617 and 665 are good examples. There are no entrance wounds to the front part of either victim's body. The sides of the arms for the two shots that went into the respective arms of ML and Giselle went to the side. There was no entrance wound to the front of their bodies. These victims, the evidence showed, were fleeing at the time they were shot. And they did not pose a threat.
Mr. Nicholson's counsel stated, too, that to the left goes to the cars or the garage or allegedly where the service revolver was. To the right goes out into the street for fleeing purposes. Is that relevant to Mr. Nicholson's state of mind as to what was happening?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is, because his state of mind and his intent was clearly to kill the victims. That's plain based on the fact that he shoots them while they're facing away, that he uses every one of the 13 bullets he had to shoot them.
But you said that they went to the left, they were fleeing. Wouldn't fleeing have been to the right?
Your Honor, fleeing, it depends on what their ultimate goal was. Was it to gather outside the house, not knowing how long it would take Mr. Nicholson to retrieve the weapon? Was it fleeing in a panic because they're being chased by a man that they believe has gone to get a gun?
Then is this case different if that revolver, if that weapon is recovered and tested and has any evidence of either of the children handling that gun or their mother handling that gun? I guess it's somewhat surprising that the gun was released before it was tested for any of that.
If, and it's a large if, Your Honor, based on the evidence in this case and what that would require for either of the victims to have had that gun, would have required America to step over her dying daughter, Giselle, to, instead of tending to her or checking on her dying or dead son,
pick up a gun and hide it.
To pick up a gun and hide it. For that to be her choice. And she was in the area. But the body camera video demonstrated clearly that Giselle was still alive, and not just alive in a way that a doctor would know. Alive in an apparent way, breathing, making sounds. That evidence was compelling, clearly, to the jury, who heard all of this. Heard that we did not have the photographs, heard that the gun was recovered eventually after being found in a closet within the house on September 13th by Roberto Lopez and Carlos Nieves. They dismissed that idea. But if the gun was tested and DNA was found, yes, that would have been relevant. But that's where the timeline is so important. On September 6th, that trunk is searched and the gun is not found. And the closets and the house are searched and the gun is not found. And there are not photographs. By the time that gun is located, and again, it is first located within the house, within the closet in the bedroom, moved to the trunk along with several other possessions of Matthew Nicholson, including his toy cars, his clothing.
And who moved it to the trunk?
Roberto Lopez, who was accompanied by Carlos Nieves, and both of whom testified. But at the time, there is still no reason for the state to believe that that gun was in any way implicated in this incident.
Is it relevant to Mr. Nicholson's state of mind when he reached out and shot? Is it relevant to the instruction on voluntary manslaughter or the defense of self-defense?
No, Your Honor.
If he believed that gun was in the trunk?
If he had believed the gun was in the trunk, I believe that it would have gone towards his self-defense theory, which was what his testimony all pushed towards. Mr. Nicholson testified extensively on this matter, and he did not testify that he lost control. He testified to support his self-defense argument. His own testimony undermines a claim that he was acting under the influence of sudden provocation. He testified that he was in fear. His story, however hard to believe it is in the face of the evidence, was not that he lost control, but rather that he was in fear. And if you look at the briefing in this matter, what he points to support the idea that he should have had this inferior offense instruction is not his own testimony. It's ancillary thoughts by people like Carl Bagacki from Garfield Heights Police Department, who testified about a rampage. He wasn't present. This is an officer testifying about what he thought it looked like to him who was not present, who is not in Matthew Nicholson's mind. And again, regarding the timeline, the police, when they arrive, have no reason to believe that the Jetta is implicated. Their trunk is closed. The body camera videos demonstrate that. There is no evidence of another gun being fired. There's no evidence whatsoever of the children utilizing a gun, shooting a gun, or having a gun on their persons.
Counsel, when the lesser inferior instruction was requested on the record, was there a back and forth between the trial court judge and defense counsel as to facts that they believe supported it and a reasoned decision from the judge as to why it wasn't offered?
I believe the defense counsel suggested that he was under provocation. I don't recall any significant facts being put forward, and I recall the decision being made based on following the sound precedent of the 8th District, not on a factual basis. Okay. But again, I think if this court believes that, in fact, it was an abuse of discretion to follow that precedent, this court should consider whether the evidence presented would have been sufficient on the objective and then subjective bases.
You keep saying whether it was an abuse of discretion to file that precedent. That's not the right standard, right? I mean, a court doesn't have discretion to get the law wrong. The question is, a jury instruction is going to be reviewed de novo, not under abuse of discretion.
Your Honor, I believed that the instruction should have been reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard because I believe the court has discretion to determine whether or not the instruction is proper.
Well, to the extent that there's a to the extent that it's a legal question whether or not an instruction is appropriate, that's not abuse of discretion, and that's what the issue is here.
Understood. If this court does review this issue de novo, and that I'll concede that may be the appropriate standard, this court should still affirm the judgment, both because the precedent within the 8th District was sound, that these are incompatible, and secondly, if this court reviews the evidence, and there would be no need for additional inquiry to the evidence. The evidence is what it is at this point. There wasn't going to be additional testimony taken to acquire or to make this instruction proper. The evidence is insufficient for this evidence if reviewed under State v. Shane. Matthew Nicholson was not injured. There was no evidence that a gun was used except for his arguably incredible testimony related to America hiding the gun. And he started this incident.
With the situation that is being proffered, that Matthew thought the kids were going for the gun because they went left instead of right, is right would have gone straight out into the street or into an open area, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And right left might have been, I mean, is it possible the jury could have inferred that that didn't matter because going left might have been a way for the kids to actually hide or take cover because they could have gotten in between the cars?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I would point this court to Exhibit 319. That is the modified phone call that makes the 911 audio as clear as possible from when ML called the police directly before Mr. Nicholson went to the bedroom or while he was going to the bedroom. He was panicked. You could hear within that call him saying, "We've got to go, we've got to go." That door opens. The diagrams are within the record and the photographs are present. The door opens to the right, and it's a very narrow driveway. One car fits next to the house. Directly outside the door, America Polanco's Jeep is parked. The children were shot and fell dead next to that Jeep, just outside the doorway. So they open the door to the right, they go to the left. It's not even clear that they would have been able to quickly both go around that door with the cars parked in the driveway. So there are many reasons. And again, these are panicked people being chased by a man with a gun, being shot to death just after leaving the house. And the fact that these bullets all entered the backsides of their respective bodies, arguably the side of each of their arms. And the final bullet, again, none of these bullets missed their target. One bullet gets stopped in Giselle's book bag of 13. That goes to Mr. Nicholson's intent, and that goes to the lack of a need for self-defense. Even if, under the incredible scenario that he watched them get his gun out of the trunk, meets them outside, they're not a threat to him. They're facing away from him. They're trying to get away from him. But again, there was no evidence supporting that gun, and I do want to revisit the timeline because I feel like I've gotten continuously back to other facts. There was no reason for the police on September 13th, when this gun is finally recovered, this service weapon, to believe that even under a self-defense theory, that this gun was involved. Mr. Nicholson points to, in his briefing, a jail call and a statement made by his father that's recorded on body camera to the effect that if they jumped you, we'll find that out. Not if they shot at you, not if they got your gun. Lieutenant Vargo testified, and this is in the transcript, at 4216 to 4217, during the entirety of his conversation with Mr. Nicholson, which was him attempting to de-escalate a situation and keep Mr. Nicholson from potentially killing himself. There was no point in time that Mr. Nicholson implicated self-defense or that he implicated, and this is more important, any use of a weapon by the victims or any obtaining of a weapon. So the notion that any photographs were not recorded is not something where bad faith can be shown, because the police were not in any position to understand that this gun might be involved. They arrived to a scene. There are several cars in the driveway. The trunk of Mr. Nicholson's car is closed, and they have no reason to go looking for that gun. There's testimony about them looking around for a big gun. They're just trying to secure the guns. They have no reason to be believing or thinking that there may be some exculpatory value to any of the other guns found in that house. It was merely a securing the premises where two homicides had occurred. I want to touch on the statement that America's testimony about domestic violence was uncorroborated, that I believe I heard during Nicholson's opening argument today. Shondell Smith and Connie Alshaus both testified that America had confided in them separately about her fears for herself and her children of Mr. Nicholson. This corroborates the domestic violence and specifically the threats to the lives of her children that Mr. Nicholson had made repeatedly in advance of September 5th, 2018, where he ultimately shot the victims to death in their own driveway. I'd like to touch on prior calculation and design. This court has long held, since State v. Cotton, that the element of prior calculation design, which is argued as being unsatisfied under a sufficiency of the evidence standard, requires a scheme designed to implement the calculated decision to kill. And this court traditionally looks at three factors under State v. Taylor. First, whether the victim, in this case the victims, and the accused knew each other, and if so, whether the relationship was strained. Second, whether the accused gave thought or preparation to choosing the murder weapon or the murder location. And third, whether the act was drawn out or an almost instantaneous eruption of events. Weighing those factors, this court should determine that they do weigh in favor of prior calculation and design being met. under a light most favorable to the state. First, the strained relationship was amply demonstrated at trial. Prior to killing America's children, there were specific threats made that if America ever went to the police, he would kill her children. Transcript at 3289 says that. If you listen to that jail call I highlighted earlier, Exhibit 319, there are arguments made that the state didn't demonstrate that Nicholson knew the police were being called. ML gives the address to the house during a call when he supposedly was instead calling his sister. He provides the home address where he wants the police to respond to. That's significant and compelling evidence, especially given the fact that this court has in the record demonstration of the size of that house, and that Nicholson had been in an argument with ML directly prior to that phone call, went to the bedroom to get a gun that he ultimately used to kill the victims. With regard to whether or not Nicholson gave thought or preparation to the murder weapon and location, he absolutely did. He had time and the ability to go unobstructed and alone by his own testimony to his bedroom to retrieve a weapon with 13 rounds in it, to return not only to the location where he had last seen ML, but to go outside of the house, to reach outside of the house and find the victims where they were. This is not a scenario where the accused and the victims were in the same place, such as driving in a car together. This is a situation where Mr. Nicholson left the situation, retrieved a gun, returned, went to a different location, and found the victims, shooting them in their backs. And as to whether or not this was an instantaneous eruption of events, this court has held that 1 or 2 minutes could be enough. Nicholson argues that this is about 40 seconds. There was an altercation that began several minutes before the actual shooting. But by the time Mr. Nicholson goes to get that gun, the evidence demonstrated he had made the decision to kill. That is sufficient time, and this court should not hold otherwise. This is a very fact-specific consideration. And the factors, including the strained relationship, which is severely strained, and included threats to kill the children years prior, as well as that very night. America testified that ML's life was threatened when he came down to try to stop Mr. Nicholson from abusing his mother. They weigh heavily in support of prior calculation design. The court should find that that standard has been met. If there are no further questions, I would see the rest of my time.
I do. Oh. During the penalty phase, defense puts on at least 6, maybe 7 witnesses. What is the state's best argument for aggravating circumstances?
The best argument, Your Honor, is that the aggravating circumstances in this case weighed heavily in favor of the death penalty based on the fact that the intent, the location, that these two victims were killed at the same time for the same purpose, based on their strained relationship, the fact that Mr. Nicholson believed they were causing problems between him and his girlfriend. This aggravating circumstance, of course, of conduct weighs heavily in favor of the death penalty, and the number of witnesses in mitigation do not equal quality or satisfactory or sufficient mitigation so that the aggravating circumstances would not outweigh those mitigating factors. While there were several witnesses, the state successfully rebutted the testimonies of the expert witnesses that there were not sufficient mental issues on the part of Mr. Nicholson. In fact, Darby testified that there was no evidence of traumatic brain injury, and the family issues put forward in mitigation were not sufficient in light of the fact that although there were problems in the family as Mr. Nicholson grew up, he attended private school, he was successfully employed, his parents remained together and were together at the time even of the trial and continued to give him support. And that testimony was actually established by his brother, and Mr. Nicholson was well-regarded and taken care of by his parents in spite of the familial problems.
Going to the aggravating circumstances, isn't your main theory that this was two people killed in the same course of conduct?
Yes, that is the aggravating circumstance
in
this case.
Is that your best argument?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the aggravating circumstance in this case, so that is what is to be weighed against the mitigating factor.
Understand. Yes. Thanks.
If there are no further questions, I would cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just by way of rebuttal, counsel's reference to the body camera videos made in passing should not go unnoticed by this court. When you watch the video, if you haven't already, you will have an emotional response. Counsel indicated those videos are crucial to show that the placement of the bodies, the lay of the land, that could have been done with a screenshot. That could have been done with testimony of witnesses. That could have been done with the photographs. The jury did not need to sit there for 30 minutes or 45 minutes listening to Giselle moan and cry and communicate with medics in the front yard of their neighbor's house.
And counsel, assuming that's inflammatory and prejudicial, would it have affected the outcome?
I believe it would have, yes.
What way?
Well, because the videos are so inflammatory and so emotional. And
no, they're emotional, but how are they inflammatory?
Because they evoke almost a vindictive response from the observer. As the videos watch, the lay observer is going to have the reaction of wanting to seek revenge, seek retribution. You know, there's all of the emotions that we don't want juries relying upon when they decide a case are evoked by this video. It's compelling, and again, compared to some of the other cases, there's been numerous cases decided by this court where this court has expressed concern about this issue. There's been numerous cases decided by this court, even recently, where this court admonishes prosecutors, admonishes trial judges, yet finds the error harmless. This case, until this court reverses a case like this because of evidence like this and remands it for a new trial because of evidence like this, trial judges and prosecutors are not going to take this court's admonishment consider it to have the weight that it deserves. And so I'd ask the court to reconsider that issue. Another, by way of rebuttal as well, my colleague mentions many times the intention of defendant. Matt's intention is not in dispute. Matt's intention was never in dispute. Prior calculation and design is in dispute. Whether Matt acted based upon a sudden fit of rage, again, he was described as being in a rampage, he was described as being angry, by the state's own closing argument, he was described as being angry. That's in dispute. Whether Matt acted with a reasonable belief that he was under imminent threat of serious physical harm or death, that's in dispute. But Matt's intent was not in dispute. So when my colleague stands up here and says this was evidence of his intent, the materiality test in Hartwick, in the recently decided case of Hartwick, it's not material. So evidence introduced to show intent, even if relevant, maybe shouldn't have been used because it's not material. By way of rebuttal, there was discussion between counsel and the court about going to the left, and I believe the comment was made, it depends on what their ultimate goal was. It depends on what was their ultimate goal. Their ultimate goal was irrelevant. Matt's perception of that act, Matt's perception of the fact that they go out the door and turn left is what's important, regardless of what was in the minds of ML or Giselle at the time they did it. And I would suggest that that act accompanying all of the other events that night justify factually a jury instruction of the lesser inferior offense of voluntary manslaughter. We ask the court to reverse this case, vacate Matt's conviction, and remand it for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Marshall, would you call a recess, please?